All right. Thank you, everyone. Welcome back to our 11 o'clock session on the economics of the shutdown and the Tax Act of 2017 and bankruptcy impacts that are stemming from that. I'm excited about our panel today. My name is Ellen Kennedy. I'm a member of the advisory board and I'm a partner at Densmore & Scholl. And I'd like to quickly introduce our panel members for today. To my right is Dr. Peter Evangelakis. He is a senior economist at RIMI in Washington, D.C., where he assists clients in planning and conducting economic analysis using the RIMI model. Prior to starting at RIMI, he taught undergraduate intermediate microeconomics as a lecturer at the University of Chicago. And highlights of his work include measuring effects of climate change on mortality and electricity usage and estimating air quality effects of the NOx budget program. He's also worked with the Washington Economics Group and the Human Services Coalition of Miami-Dade County. We're glad that you're here. To his right is Honorable Robert Gerber. I think many of you know Judge Gerber. He's a frequent speaker here at the MRBS, and we appreciate him coming back today. He is now of counsel with Joseph Haig Aronson in New York. He's a retired U.S. bankruptcy judge for the Southern District of New York in New York City. While on the bench, he has presided over a wide variety of Chapter 11, Chapter 7, Chapter 15, Section 304, and SIPA cases, and also served as, and perhaps still does, as an adjunct professor of law at Columbia Law School, where he teaches the Advanced Bankruptcy Seminar. He's a contributing author to Colliers on Bankruptcy. He's a fellow and former director of the American College of Bankruptcy. And Judge Gerber, we appreciate you being here, too.
Great to be here again.
And then on my far right is David Stewart. David is a principal in the public policy practice at Squire Patton Boggs in Washington, D.C. He has an emphasis on tax, international trade, and other economic matters. He has served as the majority staff director for the Committee on Ways and Means, which has exclusive jurisdiction over taxation and international trade in the U.S. House of Representatives. Mr. Stewart has played a crucial role in the passage of the major U.S. tax reform legislation in 2017, and we appreciate you coming here to tell us some of the high points, although we just have an hour. He served in many positions on Capitol Hill and was the economic policy director for a U.S. presidential nominee. David, thank you for being with us.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So I'm going to start with, we're going to talk about the impact of the federal government shutdown, the Tax Act of 2017, and how that affects us as bankruptcy practitioners. And in starting that, I wanted to talk generally about the state of bankruptcy law and bankruptcy practice, and how the laws can help or hurt those people who are seeking protection under the bankruptcy code. In theory, small businesses benefit from bankruptcy protection and reorganization, but in practice, administrative requirements can make a Chapter 11, even one that's designated a small business case, cost prohibitive. In looking at some of the recent changes to the bankruptcy law, Judge Gerber, I was going to ask you first, what other changes do you think might be helpful to the bankruptcy code that may allow for addressing some of these problems?
Ellen, I think I'd like to slice and dice your question by talking about what we can do now and what Congress has done and could do to make it better. Let me start with what we can do now. And frankly, I think there is some, but only a limited extent to which we can help small businesses both before and partly after the recently enacted congressional legislation gets put into effect. And let me be more specific in each of those two areas. Let's take the code the way it is now. And we all know, you don't need me to tell you, how poorly it works for small business debtors. Administrative expenses, being what they are, make it extraordinarily difficult to reorganize a small business debtor and, in fact, an increasingly large number of our mid-market debtors. So if we're going to solve the problem for debtor entities of that character, we have two problems. One is their lack of liquidity and their inability to keep alive from a liquidity perspective long enough to improve their operating performance. And the second is the extraordinarily burdensome admin expenses. Folks, I can't look you in the eye and tell you anything I can do about their liquidity. I can throw out some ideas under the existing statutory and rule scheme for cutting down on administrative expenses. I'm going to, you know, I'm not on the bench anymore. I'm allowed to be a little more creative than the appellate courts would ever let me do. And I'm going to sound a little bit like the emperor's new clothes, but let me throw out some things. First, and this is one where courts have already been proactive, on all but evidentiary hearings, allow participants to appear by phone. There we've made some progress. You'll have to know your own practices in your own districts to know whether we've made enough. Number two, eliminate and minimize evidentiary hearings. In fact, I'd go a step further and say, or at least invite people to think about, whether when things are stated in pleadings, because we trust the lawyers and the cases on our watch, we'll take them as true unless and until they're disputed by the other side. Or you could take a middle course and say you take the pleading and then you have somebody with knowledge of the facts just do a one-line verification so you don't have to do a separate affidavit to say the same things twice. I would also throw out the idea that maybe we set up a form Chapter 11 plan for small businesses and small mid-market businesses so that people don't have to go to the well over and over again to do stuff for the drafting of a plan that costs our clients money. You know, we do that in many districts, maybe all districts now, for Chapter 13s. You can do it with check the boxes. You can do it with column A's and column B's. Maybe that would help us cut down on the costs of Chapter 11s. And then I want to throw out a new concept for a disclosure statement. You guys are probably a mix of large cases and small. You've read disclosure statements for large debtors. I got to ask you guys, does it really need to read like that? Does it really need to be 70 pages or more in length? Does it really give the creditors of our cases what they need? I would throw out a radical concept that disclosure statements going forward be what you're going to get, what are the projections for going forward that are going to help you decide whether you're really going to get what you've been promised, what was the most recent cash flow so you can try to second guess the projections and to determine whether you believe them or not, and then, folks, pencils down. Such a disclosure statement could be prepared at a much, much lower cost than what we do now, and it would give creditors what they really need to know about. Do they really need to know the history of the world? Do they really need to have it read like a, you know, 33-act prospectus? I would suggest to you that they don't. Now, will that help? Maybe. Is it enough to help? No. So then we got to go to rules level, like rules committee level suggestions, and then we have to go to statutory changes. On the rules committee, remember what you've learned about the way that bankruptcy rules hang together. There's a difference between notice and a hearing on notice. Notice in a hearing only requires a hearing if people object. Hearing on notice requires hearings either way. Well, I've already talked about what we can do if we actually have to hold hearings, but I would throw out to you guys, consider whether everything should be a notice and a hearing. If people object, sure. If there's no objection, why subject the creditors and, more importantly, the lawyers and, more importantly, the creditors, the clients, of the expense of doing all of that? I would throw out that on matters where there is no objection, let things go through, let judges act as judges deciding disputes. Again, I think that would ultimately put money into the pockets of creditors. Lastly, let me talk about the legislation. Here there's some good news. Back on August 1st, the U.S. Senate approved on voice vote, folks, three types of significant legislation. One, which is going to help our veterans, called the Haven Act, to give more equality of treatment for their disability payments. One, which we'll be talking about a little later in the morning, Chapter 12 reform to increase the maximum amount that can be reorganized under Chapter 12 up to $10 million from its existing lower level. And third, to allow small businesses to file under a new subchapter of Chapter 11 for a dramatically simpler method for reorganizing small businesses with a lot of similarities to Chapter 13. I can talk about that in more detail. I don't want to spend too much time speaking to the exclusion of my colleagues. Basically, it would establish trustees to act as standing trustees, very much like we have Chapter 13 trustees. It would eliminate a lot of the baggage, both in terms of committees that debtors have to pay for, and in things like those very complicated disclosure statements. And again, give our small business debtors a much better chance to reorganize. Under existing figures, small businesses account for, believe it or not, about 95% of the Chapter 11s in the country. We hear about the big cases, but we've never really focused on the needs of that 95%. And Congress has stepped up to the plate. Now both houses have passed that legislation. My understanding is that that legislation has now gone or is about to go on to the president. Given its popularity on both sides of the aisle, I would hope and expect that it will be signed. But I can't tell you that that's been done yet. So those are my thoughts on small businesses, Ellen. I think I should wait before saying any more to see if we have time to do it.
Okay. All right. I appreciate that. And I do think that it's really interesting. You know, I think the bankruptcy bar has been a little sluggish in terms of cases being filed, and I think that these changes would allow for more people in that 95%, like Judge Gerber said, that might blink at just the cost of bankruptcy, might see it as a more accessible, true reorganization tool, as opposed to seeing it as truly a last resort, and that would be really positive.
Yes, Ellen, and one thing I failed to mention, and I'm going to sound greedy here. What Congress just enacted would have a cap of 2.7 million on eligibility to file. Compare that to Chapter 12 reform, which would allow 10 million. The same legislation would be much, much more effective if the cap were boosted up to $10 million. But maybe the perfect is the enemy of the good, and this legislation's a start.
It is a good start, and I will say that just in terms of trends, farm bankruptcies really are rising, and that bill that passed will make it easier for farmers with larger amounts of debt to seek bankruptcy protection. And farms, and part of the reason potentially that the farm filings are going up is because they were affected by the government shutdown earlier this year. The USDA was considered, for the most part, a non-essential agency, and there were a lot of delays in loan processing that created a significant risk for farmers that they would not get financing in time to get seeds in the ground in time for those plants to be insured, and that would cut off their income source for the year. The periodic shutdowns of the federal government are happening more frequently, and they certainly create considerable repercussions in the economy. Peter, maybe you can tell us some about what those economic impacts are and how that's affecting people in this area and nationally.
Sure, sure. So, I think there are, as a big picture, I think there's a difference between, relatively short and relatively longer shutdowns. So, even this last one was 5 weeks. I think that was caused enough consternation. But I think overall it had still a relatively muted effect on the economy, certainly not in all areas of the economy. So, for example, all of the federal workers, had to go, month plus without pay, but they all got back pay. But there are other services like, the metro, the D.C. metro, where, a lot of the federal workers in D.C., where the demand fell as people were not going to work, or the restaurants in the area were not being frequented, for lunch. You also saw federal contractors who, were not necessarily repaid, from the top down to, relatively low-wage workers who were not guaranteed back pay, and that could certainly have an impact very directly on consumption, especially with the lower-wage workers having, relatively high kind of propensity to consume, like, whatever they're bringing in, they have to spend into the economy. And so that may have somewhat of an impact. I think also looking at what are the effects on some of the government services. So we talked a little bit about USDA certainly I think eventually opening up some kind of emergency farm aid, but that being kind of curtailed for a period, Small Business Administration, not approving new loans, and certainly in the there may be some small businesses that were not able to wait that long and may not have become viable when they could have otherwise, and certainly a big one that I travel a lot for work, a lot of us may, and certainly TSA was a concern during that period, and I think that may be one of those areas where as you get longer, as the shutdown gets longer, there may be more rustling to, people start taking sick days, and certainly if there are delays and cancellations, in flying around the country, that's going to have a major economic impact. So I think overall, I think hopefully dodged, at least from a macro sense, kind of dodged a bullet. But I think, if there's increased frequency and hopefully not, but increased duration, I think that could have more structural change. Another thing I would say is, hearing from some federal workers, maybe there's a propensity to, maybe save a little bit more than they would have otherwise in order to kind of buffer themselves against future shutdowns that may kind of slow the pace of economic growth as well. Going forward, government jobs are also seen as very, very safe. If they're seen as less safe, that may have some kind of structural impacts going forward as well.
So is it fair to say that we don't totally know the economic repercussions quite yet in August, in light of the fact that it's only been a couple months difference?
Yeah. I think that's right. We can kind of track, quarter by quarter and see, where kind of economic growth is going. We can track some indicators. Obviously, since then, other issues have, kind of been driving kind of economic news, like trade issues and things like that, that may also have an impact that we'd want to disentangle from the effects of the shutdown.
Right. Ellen, let me just take a second. I don't want to be talking too much today about the same thing's effects on the U.S. bankruptcy courts, where you guys are going to be looking for service. If we have another government shutdown, bankruptcy judges are going to still show up for work. So will their law clerks. So will at least some members of the clerks' offices that back up the chambers. Depending on the amount of cash reserves, perhaps all of them. And there will be at least some or perhaps one representative of the U.S. trustee program staying on the job to give us the support that's also essential, even though the first class of people I was talking about come from the judicial branch and U.S. trustee personnel come from the executive branch. But you will see problems if it goes on for any time, not just in the form of us running the paper through the laser printers a second time. That's why we really ask you for courtesy copies, just to give us this reserve of paper. And during sequestration, we ran out of paper. You will see it in delays in docketing, and you will see it in the U.S. Trustees Program being able to function to a certain degree, but not what at the level we've been used to.
Now, I do, from my own practice, I know that during the shutdown it was very frustrating to get a couple cases to completion because the U.S. Attorney's Office, some of their civil attorneys had been put on a furlough, and I was waiting for some kind of agreement from either the USDA or the SBA or the IRS or Health and Human Services, and the U.S. attorneys who show up in bankruptcy court represent all of those agencies. And when they were on furlough, we were waiting. There was like an objection pending, but the attorney couldn't. We had to keep postponing the hearing because we couldn't get input from the attorney or otherwise resolve issues that in theory could have been resolved. So it does create some delays and some hiccups. And what do you think in terms of, and I'll ask either David or Peter this, do you think that using shutdowns as a political tool will continue? And what are the chances of that? And is there anything we should do in counseling clients to prepare for that?
Well, I think as long as two things remain constant as they are today, that the answer is yes. I think as long as the appropriations process consists of a number of bills or one bill that the Congress must act on before the fiscal year expires and the new fiscal year begins, and as long as the shutdown is viewed as an opportunity for usually one party and usually as an opportunity to achieve or try to achieve a completely unattainable policy goal, then I think the answer is yes. I think politics usually overwhelm this to a considerable degree. But having said that, I do think that the sequester has come up a couple times. I think now that the BCA sequester of 2012 has run its course, I think there's probably less likelihood of a shutdown being viewed as a tool. But it's not always about the spending levels. You go back to 2016, I believe, we had a 16-day shutdown. And it was entirely driven by some members in the Republican Party insisting that we should keep the government shut down until President Obama signed a law to repeal his signature health care achievement, ACA. I mean, that's a nonsensical proposition. But the politics overwhelm these things sometimes and overtake the situation. But it's important, I think, as we all think about how we are viewing future possible shutdowns, to think about what the shutdown can be. It's not just about the duration. That's an important factor, certainly, for the economy and the effects of a shutdown. But the appropriations process is 12 individual bills, and to the degree that a shutdown occurs once the new fiscal year starts, it's only for those agencies governed by a bill that has not already been enacted. And so that's why each of these shutdowns can make a different impact across the government, because it's not always a complete government shutdown. And so to the point about USDA, if the agriculture bill has been enacted, for example, and the rest of the government shuts down, these agriculture issues are not going to be the same problem they would be otherwise absent that. But you do see drastic economic effects that were averted in this lengthy shutdown here, usually by the government contorting itself, reversing opinions, changing interpretations of how they're supposed to act. You know, also in the Department of Agriculture, we saw effects beyond discretionary spending, nearly affecting mandatory spending and nutrition assistance. This is millions of beneficiaries receiving on average $122 a week, very price-sensitive individuals. We saw a reverse of interpretation by OMB this time during the shutdown. We were going into the filing season, first filing season after the Tax Cut and Jobs Act. Typically, tax returns being processed, not viewed as an essential life-saving service of the federal government. And so here was the prospect of not only returns not being processed, but refunds not being processed. That would have had a significant impact on cash flow into the economy from the government. So there's a number of different aspects to a shutdown beyond duration that I think are worth monitoring and considering if we near our situation like this again. But looking ahead to the balance of this fiscal year, I think we just saw in July a deal cut between the Congress and the President that was signed. This is a typical process because ever since the sequester was put in place and cuts have been looming on the discretionary side, Congress has found a way to find a deal to avoid those cuts. And this was no different. This was a two-year deal for fiscal 20, fiscal 21, in addition extending the debt limit suspension for 2 years. So that takes a lot of pressure off the fiscal policy making in the appropriations space. The deal is not the sum total of avoiding a government shutdown, though. Each of these 12 bills, or more likely a combination of them in an omnibus, still needs to be enacted in order to avoid a shutdown. And those details, the programmatic level details, will still need to be negotiated. But having the top line discretionary numbers solved as part of this deal takes an enormous amount of pressure off that process. And I would suspect there is a very high degree of likelihood that we will not see another shutdown come the balance of this year and probably not into next. The one wild card to that, I think, is the President himself that signed the deal that is going to take the pressure off a shutdown. So we will see, but I think the likelihood has gone down, at least in the near term. But I do suspect this will continue to remain an attractive policy tool for the future Congresses.
Yeah, it seems like it would, irrespective of the bills that give us a little bit of breathing room right now. I think it's something that now, once people have seen that unfold, it's become something that is now a tool in the mm-hmm. political arsenal in a way that it certainly had not been up until the last couple years. And I do think for our consumer practitioners, the delay in tax refunds for consumers, you know, definitely. I'm curious to see if there's some blip in consumer filings around the time that there was delays in relation to consumers getting tax refunds, because often there's a lot of things that they put off or need or can't otherwise afford unless that refund comes in. Mm-hmm. And speaking of refunds, there's been a lot of changes to the tax code that have affected people's refunds and what they were expecting to get, both on a consumer and business level. And David, if you could tell us some of the overview or the major changes that taxpayers need to know and any sunset provisions that we might need to be aware of.
Sure. Well, I won't spend too much time on what has changed in part of the law. It was obviously a significant rewrite of the tax code, the most significant in 31 years, and it affected most aspects of the code, including in particular for individuals, pass-throughs, and corporate entities, a dramatic reduction of rates and rate structures. A new pass-through deduction for pass-through entities, a move toward full expensing for all sizes of businesses, a number of international changes, and on and on and on. And so those changes are in effect. I think there has been there's been some confusion and disagreement about how Treasury and the IRS set up new procedures for withholding under the new law and how people are reacting as they're going to file their returns. But those are significant changes to the tax code. One aspect of the bill, though, that is important to keep in mind is because of the process that we used to pass the bill through the Congress, it had severe limits on what we were able to do and when, mostly surrounding the revenue effects of the bill. And as a result of that, there are some very significant elements of the new law that are not permanent. And those are going to be the things that are going to be cascading across the policy arena over the next 2, 3, 4, 5 years. And those are going to be the important things to watch, I think, from our perspective here. The law was designed, though, to try to maximize the ability of a future Congress to have the political viability to not only deal with one of these sunsets, but multiple sunsets. And by that I mean there may be one provision that's expiring that is more important to one political party versus another. And so the law actually tried to make these cliffs align so that there were multiple provisions expiring at the same time, and the theory being that they would have the political bandwidth to get pulled along together. And so the first big series of these is going to be at the end of 2022. And these are related to the business interest expense limitation of 30%. And the law right now factors that taxable income baseline on EBITDA. After 2022, the law will reflect only EBIT. And so that'll be a big change for some taxpayers. Full expensing begins to phase down after 2022. And R&D expenses. Currently, an expensable event for a business now would have to be amortized over 5 years. So there's a cluster in 2022. The big one is at the end of 2025. And the big sunsetting piece of the law is the entire individual code changes. The 23 provisions that were modified in the individual income code all go away. In effect, after 2025, for individual taxpayers, the law is the same as it was before. So this is the increased standard deduction, the lower rates, the increased child tax credit. All of those things go away. And so that is also occurring at the same time that the 20% pass-through deduction would expire as well. So you can see the pairing here with small businesses and the income side for individuals. I don't think that that's likely to happen. I think, you know, like we saw with the 2001 and 2003 tax relief bills, when it came time for those to expire, Congress found a deal to be had to extend and make permanent 99% of that relief from 01 and 03. I suspect that'll be the same thing here, which leads...
So there are mechanisms for that to happen? It's not written in such a way that it sunsets no matter what?
Sunsets no matter what.
But is there an override that... renew it? What's the process
for that? Congress would have to pass additional legislation to either extend or make permanent those provisions. I think that, you know, the point of why the individual side was sunset versus something else is the overwhelming political pressure that is going to be placed on a future Congress in 2025 or 2024 to think and face the prospect of increased rates on their constituents, a child tax credit being cleaved in half, a standard deduction being almost cut in half. That's going to be an enormous political event for the Congress to have to deal with. And so I think while they will need to act and pass new legislation to do that, I think there will be enormous pressure for them to do so.
Okay. All right. And what about state and local taxes? I know that a lot of municipalities and states are getting creative with their taxing programs to supplement or otherwise work around some things that are happening in the federal government. Peter, what can you tell us about that?
Sure. So one of those changes in the TCJA was the cap on state and local tax deductions at $10,000 per household. So I think right away, I think there were states like, you know, New York and a number of others that were, you know, that kind of floated several ideas that I think at this point have not worked out, have been shot down. But you know, including things like, you know, changing from an income tax to a payroll tax in order to try to avoid the cap. As well as, you know, submitting state taxes as charitable contributions. So I think that was always a little bit even more of a long shot, I think. And I think there were a few others. I know actually one of our clients did a study of another kind of voluntary tax in New York State, a proposal that also tried to kind of circumvent the cap on the deduction. I think, you know, what's interesting here is some of the politics of, you know, the state and local tax deduction cap. You know, obviously, you know, a lot of the kind of higher tax states like New York and California are blue states, and so certainly this was a way for the Republican-led, White House and Congress to, potentially kind of politically punish, along with some of their economic reasons why they might support this. There was also maybe some political motivation, and so of course you saw pushback right away from, you know, Governor Cuomo and things like that, but there. A lot of obviously kind of heterogeneity kind of regionally across the country, you know, obviously like states like New York and California as opposed to states like Florida and Texas, where there's no income tax, where overall the tax environment is much less burdensome. I would say, you know, here, you know, we're here in the Midwest, we did, our firm, I did a study of some of the regional impacts, you know, kind of national and regional impacts of the TCJA, back in early 2018 after it had been passed. And so we were able to look kind of state by state and see, what are some of the different impacts. And so we see, here in Ohio, obviously we're in Ohio, Indiana and Kentucky, relatively more modest impacts, relatively moderate, income tax rates, relatively kind of either median or below median sales tax rates, and relatively low, especially Indiana and Kentucky, relatively low property tax per capita. So the cap was less burdensome, relatively speaking. Here, the property tax, lower property taxes, largely driven by, much lower than average kind of house prices in this region. So you saw, looking at just this piece, looking at just the state and local tax deduction cap, that piece alone was a tax increase. Obviously, the TCJA overall was generally speaking a tax decrease, but this piece of it was a tax increase. But it was not evenly distributed, and we looked at not only the economic impacts, but also some of the demographic impacts. For example, Governor Cuomo in New York, has been concerned about folks moving from New York to Florida, and that is kind of a dynamic that we kind of predicted as well, looking at essentially this driving, a decrease in after-tax wages everywhere, as this piece of it being an increase in taxes. But that, that increase in after-tax wages being much more dramatic in states like New York and California than in Florida or Texas or even, here in the Midwest. And so, for example, you would see, large declines in, in-migration into, or potential out-migration from New York and California and New Jersey, and, large influx into, Florida and Texas, but also into Ohio, as well as Kentucky and Indiana as being, relatively, the impacts of the cap being relatively less dramatic here, and these areas becoming comparatively more attractive after the fact.
Maybe I could just add a couple more points to this discussion, because it really is kind of somewhat counterintuitive that states react this way. We went back and studied this issue from major tax reforms like 86, and what you find is that revenue to state coffers actually increases after a tax reform bill such as the one we just did. I would expect that will be the same here as we get more data to look at. Going back to the expiration and the sunsets, the SALT limitation is also one of those provisions that is expiring at the end of 2025. And just looking ahead as to what's going to happen to this limitation, I would simply suggest that while there is a lot of attention right now on this limitation, particularly from high-tax states like California and New York, I don't think there's going to be an opportunity to address, if at all, or change this issue absent the context of dealing with all of those other 22 changes that I described on the individual side. So I think this will be in place for the near term, at least until 2025, in my view. And so we'll have ample time to study the effects.
Okay, and looking ahead is a lot of what it is that we want to talk about today in terms of what's happening with the tax code, state and local taxes, the possibility of shutdowns, and also just generally the future of the business of bankruptcy and the business of filing bankruptcy. Statistically, filings are down in all avenues. I think 12s are holding steady or nudging a little up. And there are a lot of reasons, potential reasons for that. Like we discussed at the beginning of our talk, in Chapter 11 cases, administrative costs could be a factor or a discouraging factor to file. Also, just economically, there's really low interest rates right now, so a lot of consumers can sort of refinance their way out of trouble, as can small businesses and large businesses. I'd like to talk a little bit, Judge Gerber, perhaps you can talk with me about what's potentially causing the trend of sort of slow file or a lower level of filings than we've seen before, and what we see the future of the bankruptcy practice might be based on some of the economic factors that we see in the future.
I'll take the first crack at that and then invite other people.
And a crystal ball, you know, I hope you brought your crystal ball because we're going to hold you to all.
Well, I have looked into my crystal ball, and my crystal ball is that I see events that are going to be bad for the country but good for the people in this room. If you look back over the last several years for the decrease in bankruptcy filings, I think it's a combination of several factors. Administrative expenses of 11s, and we talked about this before, have had, in my judgment, a chilling effect on 11 filings. I think that because of the difficulty of reorganizing an 11 for all but the very largest companies, that forced a lot of them, in my judgment, too many of them, into alternate mechanisms such as assignments for the benefit of creditors or even liquidations. That's unfortunate because what it means is the death of companies that we would like to keep alive, not just for the families that run those businesses, but also for the communities in which they operate. But I think there are other factors as well, and I think you can see it in part by comparing and contrasting the situation now, and especially a year ago, from the way it was back in 2009 when we had filings like GM, General Motors, on my watch, Chrysler on Arthur Gonzalez's watch, and Lehman, actually that was back in 2008, before first Jim Peck and then Shelley Chapman. At the time, there was a crisis of liquidity. There was a dramatic decrease in demand. And the congressional response to it was, in substantial part, trying to pump more money into the economy. And, of course, as part of that, reductions in taxes, which resulted in an increase from 2009 through almost to this month in overall growth in the economy, which have had a corresponding decrease in Chapter 11 filings. Now, debtors still do lots of dumb things. By that I mean commercial debtors, most significantly leverage buyouts. But those affect the largest companies more than they affect the smaller and mid-market companies. Another factor that is helpful for us to understand is the rise in secured debt in the debtors on our watch. That means that debtors live at the sufferance of their secured creditors for liquidity, consent to use cash collateral, and willingness to prime themselves to provide dip financing. But basically, what we have seen is an environment that has been relatively healthy for companies. Maybe it didn't help consumers so much. But for companies in that environment, they did okay, or better than okay, with a corresponding decrease on Chapter 11 business for many of the people in this room. Now, when we first started planning this panel a couple of months ago, we weren't thinking about recession as much as we were thinking now. And in fact, things were sufficiently healthy that I had predicted interest rates staying low and even dropping more, which would mean less corporate difficulty for companies that had secured debt that floated. Large debtors' debt floats on LIBOR, typically, and low interest rates are very good for them. Conversely, if interest rates would go up, as I had predicted they would when the economy was increasingly healthy, they would take a hit, and I thought that would cause them difficulty, especially if they were tightly leveraged. Now we see, since we've started planning this panel, a different phenomenon. Interest rates may not go up. There is even political pressure. I'm going to leave it to my experts on the political process to cause interest rates to go down. Well, then you won't have the pressure on LIBOR that you had before, but you're going to have a recession, which means taking a hit not just for companies that work off domestic demand, but for consumers as well. The fears of the recession, I can't predict. I'd lead to people like Peter to tell us whether we're going to have a recession. If there is a recession, it's going to be lousy for the company, but it may be helpful for the people who have to pick up the pieces for that, like those in the room. And now I think I should defer to my colleagues who know more about economics and the political process. That's my take as a guy who used to be up close to the bankruptcy system.
I will attest to the fact that the nature of our conversations have definitely meandered since we first got together to discuss what we were going to talk about based on the political ins and outs and shifts during the summer. Peter, do you have any thoughts? Do you have a crystal ball under there yourself about whether or not we're looking at a recession potentially?
Sure. I don't know how much of a crystal ball, but I can speak to, you know, some of the potential concerns. I mean, certainly, it's I guess indicative when you hear the words inverted yield curve on a late night show that's kind of meandered into the popular vernacular. Where, of course, that being you know kind of short term interest rates kind of rising above kind of 10-year bond rates. And that's historically, you know, I think 6 or 7 times since the 60s has preceded a recession within a year or two. So I think that's been one concern. I know, back in D.C., Mark Zandi came and, you know, I'm a member of the National Economists Club, and Mark, we had Mark Zandi of Moody's Analytics, come and give his thoughts and, his thought was, probably within the next year and a half. I think that's roughly a consensus, by 2020 or 2021. So I don't do that kind of forecasting. So I don't know if I have any more of a crystal ball, but I do think that the consensus is growing. That certainly job growth is a little bit slower this year than last. And with the inverted yield curve and maybe some other indicators, maybe going that direction.
Mm-hmm. I think we're going to hear more about it. I'll just put a political veneer on top of this discussion. I think we're going to hear a lot more about it because, I think correctly or incorrectly, I think the narrative is taking hold that the sitting president is going to be running on the economy as the key pillar of his reelection campaign. And so I think you're going to see a lot of people trying to find every nook and cranny of the economy they can. That's suggesting a weakening economy headed toward recession. Like just this week, the Wall Street Journal was reporting that RV sales are down year over year, 20%. So that's an indicator. I think we're going to start seeing things like this more and more, I think, because there's political value in defining the economy in different ways as we go into a presidential election, too.
Yeah, and I do think that has a lot of impact, irrespective of how much it's actually taken hold, how much people are talking about it, and how much it's being discussed. Like Peter said, it's on late-night TV shows. I certainly did not hear about inverted yield curves from Jay Leno when I was...
Oh, and Ellen, there's one other thing we haven't talked about yet. And if Peter can't have a crystal ball on this, I sure can. Or you, Dave. But we haven't yet talked trade war. Now, trade war is going to have an effect. It's already had an effect on the agricultural sector. And if there is an escalation in the trade war, as we almost had vis-a-vis a lot of finished goods, some of these increases vis-a-vis China have been deferred. That would not give me a great deal of confidence for the health of the country, although I think it would provide, if you care about this, some confidence for what you guys are going to make in the next year or two. It's trying to pick up the pieces. The trade war may so far have had a disproportionate effect upon the agricultural community and certain sectors of the larger manufacturing sector. I don't have enough expertise on this, but as a person who has some exposure to it but not a PhD in economics, I would be paying attention to the trade war as potentially having an effect upon bankruptcy filings going forward.
I think so, too. I think that, you know, there's a lot of efforts made to try to, depending on who's talking, the consumer is or isn't paying for a lot of the impact of this of these trade wars. But I think that the public perception, irrespective, and all of these things are happening and there's a lot of moving parts, but you know, with it being on TV and being, like David said, being discussed a lot, I think that that's going to create some issues as far as consumer confidence and some other things. I think there's going to be a little more personal conservative approach to finances and how one runs a household budget and things like that, and ultimately all of that has a serious ripple effect, and especially if you have the trade war on the other side where you have people buying less because they're a little concerned about what, you know, this recession talk that they're hearing about, and not only are they buying less, but, you know, products or some part of products, so much being manufactured overseas is going to create a crunch through the trade war as well, and so that's going to impact a lot of businesses and a lot of employees and so on. So I do think, you know, I certainly am not as qualified as these guys, but it just seems like there is a little bit of pessimism that's kind of creeping in terms of the economy.
I think there's an economic effect. There's certainly an uncertainty effect that is causing concern for businesses, but we really haven't seen anything like this in recent years. I mean, we have a president who is taking power delegated to him by the Congress and unilaterally acting not just on China. China receives a lot of the attention, and rightly so, but on steel and aluminum and maybe autos and auto parts and maybe titanium. So it is a widespread panoply of potential tariffs on an economy on products that are deeply embedded in supply chains. And tariffs are taxes. Less is better. Zero is best. And we're seeing the economic effects of that. I think we're also seeing the uncertainty, like I said, of a president who on a whim will tweet that we're going to put tariffs on the rest of Chinese imports to the United States. And by the way, we're going to do that on September 1st. And then 2 weeks later say, well, we're not going to do that on September 1st. We're going to do that on December 1st. And, oh, maybe we'll exempt cell phones because Tim Cook came and visited me in the White House. I mean, how do you have certainty in that environment? And that has got to have and has been having, in my view, an economic dampening effect, certainly on the business decisions of smaller employers, maybe making limited investments. I mean, all these things are cascading through this, and it is a really unprecedented time on the trade front. No question.
So, you know, they say, may you live in interesting times is not necessarily a blessing. So,
no.
But I think for, as Judge Gerber said, for the people sitting in this room, when businesses fall apart, we're all here to help. So I think that, you know, the general pessimism about the economy could lead to a growing interest in going back to bankruptcy, especially if some of these, you know, if there are some changes and some other things that happen in the bankruptcy law that make it a little more accessible, a little easier, and there's not the sticker shock on the front end. I personally would love to see bankruptcy go back to being a true reorganizational tool, a business tool, as opposed to just a way to sell everything. And I think that you know, it's interesting work and it's really helpful, and the cases that do make it all the way through to reorganization, it's a great feeling to be on the other side of that, as it is when you're working with consumers who, you know, can really get that fresh start in the way that the bankruptcy code was intended to give them. So with that, I'll ask if anybody has any questions for any of our panelists. Come on up.
Okay, for the economists up there, there's been very little discussion about the effect of deficits. If we do have a recession, does the growing deficit cause a problem in having some way of dealing with a recession? And what are we going to do if we just continue to ignore deficits?
Sure, that's a great question, and I know that's that was one of the concerns that a lot of people brought up with with the TCJA being a tax cut paired with the omnibus spending bill, kind of greatly increasing the deficit in the time of where we're still booming, and we are we are sitting at a very large deficit, and that may very well lead to less political appetite to increase the deficit further when it's needed in terms of staving off or kind of counteracting a recession. I think economists differ in how much how much weight to put behind the size of the deficit. I know that there are certainly deficit hawks who are very concerned, and then there are others who think it can grow larger without too much effect, at least in the short term. So I think it may come down to more a question in the short term of, how does it affect the political will to do what's needed? Hopefully it won't be as bad as it was, 10, 11 years ago. But certainly hopefully there's some room, to kind of do some counter-cyclical spending, if needed.
If I may, too, it is a serious issue, and the answer from an economic perspective is absolutely it's a concern. I think, though, a couple observations from my 18 years in the House of Representatives as a staffer, I can tell you Congress is not very good at turning in its homework early, and dealing with these big problems is one of those things that I think has been a persistent problem. I was the policy director to Speaker Boehner. We had a subsequent negotiation with President Obama on entitlements that would have helped address this issue, and that fell apart because the political headwinds against it were so severe. In a subsequent budget deal we negotiated with President Obama, we were able to get some entitlement reforms that helped move the needle a little bit in the SSDI program, but that was 0.4% of payroll over 75 years. So clearly there's got to be an appetite to address the real big drivers of what is causing this, and that has not materialized yet. So I think it's going to be a persistent problem until there is a real crisis that the markets present to the government with all of this debt and deficits.
Any other questions?
Among many hats, I serve as a Chapter 12 trustee. And my question is maybe twofold, but one is, I read in the past week that farm income has dropped from something like $113 billion to $63 billion in the last 5 years. And I may be wrong on the number, but it was a startling decrease in revenue. I recall from my reading that the 20s was a miserable time to be a farmer, but it took America 10 years to get to the Depression. Is the farm industry, the agricultural industry, any kind of indicator of where we may be headed as a nation in terms of a recession? That's one. And two, regardless of one's political views on immigration, is the ongoing immigration war, whatever you want to call it, does that also have an impact on agricultural income and whether it will also trigger a recession?
Well, Mike, I can say that just from some of the work that I've done with both farmers and agricultural lenders, just anecdotally, there's been a lot more forbearance agreements, defaults. I'm from Lexington in Kentucky, eastern western Kentucky. I've definitely seen an increase just anecdotally in, in my area, of people who are throwing in the towel because they can't make it work. And I can't speak to the macroeconomics of that, but as you refer to, as if history is our guide, then yes, I do think that agriculture is an indicator, because as food gets more expensive, everyone has to eat. And so as food gets more expensive and people have less and less ability to afford what they must have, the consumption of other goods is going to drop off, and that does have a significant
ripple effect in addition to the tariffs and everything else. As to the immigration question, I see David nodding, and I hope that means he has an answer, because
I was nodding
sure
about the tariffs.
How to respond to that?
I want to defer to our economics colleague here, but I mean, agriculture seems to me to be an industry that is uniquely disproportionate effect by the tariffs that have been imposed. And certainly there's been a chilling effect by the Chinese on purchases of U.S. agricultural products and so on. So I think it is a real area of the economy that's been really severely hit. I agree.
I would certainly agree with that, and I would echo, Alan, what you're saying. You know, as, you know, everybody has to eat, you know, especially, you know, again, kind of talking about maybe some, you know, a lot of, you know, lower income folks, you know, where that definitely kind of one for one squeezes out their budget to spend on other things, and, you know, not only makes their life harder, but also, of course, you know, can slow down kind of, you know, economic growth in other areas, certainly.
That's a good question. Any other questions? If not, thank you. Thank you, panelists, for coming today. And I think we're breaking for lunch.
Coach?
Thanks. Enjoyed it.
Thank you.